Joining me on stage are Fritz Schwartz and Carl Kolbe. Carl is an Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker. He's written, directed, and produced commercials, corporate communications, documentaries, TV specials, and on and on and on. And Fritz is here because he has not won an Emmy. Fritz, however, is currently chief counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice. He's the author of two books, and he is writing a third book, which is due out next year, and it will explore the nature of secrecy and power. He's also here tonight because without having previously known a single senator, he was appointed chief counsel to the Senate Select Committee to study governmental operations with respect to intelligence activities. I can get that out of my mouth. The Church Committee. Anyway, please join us for what will surely be a lively and exciting discussion on justice oversight and film. Thank you, guys.
You go ahead.
Well,
thanks for inviting me.
First, that was a really powerful film, and I admire you for doing it. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what surprised you in making the film about the CIA or your father, and what was hard for you in making the film?
Well, the hard part was going beyond the politic and going beyond the policy kind of questions that are raised, which are serious questions, but to go into the personal motivation of my father and what was the family dynamic really about? I mean, were we just a cover? Questions of that nature. And then the positive side, I would say I initially started with a little renewed respect for him and his courage, really, and in the beginning of his career and the end of his career, and his willingness to sort of absorb and to inflict pain. He operated at a higher boiling point than most people in this room. One of his buddies from law school once said, "You could be sawing off his left arm as you're talking to him about the weather today." And he would just continue and talk about the weather and be very median, very calm. But then I discovered that I think he was an expert at deflecting problems and personal motivational issues. But then at the same time, I would track back and see, well, what made him take the stand that he took? And that's something that I'd like to ask you about, because you knew him very well.
Well, I didn't really know him well, but I saw him a lot and took his testimony many times. I think he was motivated by a desire to save the CIA. I think he felt without having an honest exposure, the CIA would be killed by a death of a thousand cuts. I think he was influenced by his being a lawyer and having a respect for the constitutional system. I never felt he rolled over at all. I mean, we worked out with your father and with the White House and with the FBI ground rules on how we were going to protect respectable secrets, like the names of agents or the names of people who were giving us information, or even the names of low-level people who did bad things. We always exposed the higher-level people. But I found your father a person who was doing a job in a professional way, and I thought for good motives, his cooperation with us.
How would you contrast the way the Church Committee hearings were conducted and their results and Pike hearings? Because,
well, I'll give an opinion on that, and then I'd like to hear what was talked about at the dinner table on that subject. But
he respected the Church Committee's thrust and their methodology. I think you probably were aware of that. Whereas with Pike, I think he felt there was almost, maybe correct me, but I think Pike never concluded and wrote a final report that was particularly critical of the agency. So I think he felt that Pike was more posturing than it was substantial.
We were a success. The church committee in the Senate was a success, and the House committee was a failure. I think to a substantial extent it was their fault that they were a failure, because they would refuse, for example, we made a deal with the intelligence agencies that when they produced documents to us, and the document might have in it the name of, in the case of the FBI, a name of an informer that they'd put into the NACP or to Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference, or in the CIA case, it might include the name of a lower-level person who was providing information to the CIA. And we said, in the first instance, the FBI or the CIA can redact that name. If we thought we needed it, then we would get it. The House stood on a principle of absolutism and refused. And the other difference was the Church Committee had only two leaks. Neither had the slightest to do with national security. One was that a friend, a mutual friend of John Kennedy and the head of the mafia in Chicago, was the mistress of both of them. And we referred to her, she didn't have anything to do with the killing effort to kill Castro. We referred to her as a friend. So they had lots of leaks, and so they were irresponsible and we were responsible.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I'd like to ask your opinion on as well, because you saw him in a sense, well, in combative mode, or he was cooperating, but it was jousting, to say the least, is that in the film you can see that I refute, even though very well intentioned, when Kyle introduced the film, he said that, and some observers might say, my father had Catholic guilt about what he had done in Phoenix, and so this led to this sort of bloodletting later, and let's reveal all the secrets of the agency, as if he was outraged by it. I mean, number one, the CIA is obviously very compartmentalized, so as the head of the Far East Division and high up in the DO, the operations directorate, he's not aware of what might be going on, particularly in Guatemala, or it's not as if the whole agency gets together like this and they all have a big love fest and tell each other all of their contacts. Because if you tell him who your contact is in Damascus today, well, he's probably dealing perhaps with that agent who is running someone else. And then now you've told him that's your contact. This could be terrible for you and lead to his complete being revealed and possibly killed. So there's a lot of compartmentalization going on. I felt it was more that he, in some ways, as Woodward said, that where's the authority? Moral or otherwise. And Article 1 is a very powerful article. And faced with a congressional hearing where you raise your hand and take the oath, who's the authority?
Yeah, I never felt guilt in contact with him. He was straightforward. He would say some things were wrong, things like giving LSD to unsuspecting people on whom the CIA experimented with, and then some of them died. He would say something like that was wrong, but I never saw guilt. He wasn't an open sieve either. We had to press for the information. In fact, the first time I saw your father, I think he didn't like me, because he was a first witness for us in executive session, and he was coming to say we did try to kill people. But I pushed him, saying, well, now we need to have the following classes of documents. Will you agree, sitting here in front of the senators, to give them? And he was mad at me. So I never thought he was a wimp. I thought he felt, and I don't think he felt guilty as far as I could see, I thought he felt it was important to be honest with a responsible congressional committee, and that it would hurt the CIA if they died a death of a thousand cuts, as the newspapers, you know, gradually got all this information.
Well, Henry Kissinger obviously opposed his testimony at the time and felt that he should behave as Helms probably would have, which is to basically say it's none of your business.
Well, more than none of your business, to fudge in a way that is right next to lying if it isn't
right.
Lying.
Well, it became almost Shakespearean because obviously Helms, if you don't know, you know, but was my father's mentor all along. Even brought him back from Saigon after running pacification in Phoenix and installed him as the executive director / controller of the agency, which was an obvious stepping stone to replace him. Big question mark, which I don't know if you've ever asked yourself, is why did Nixon pick him? And my suspicion is that he can control him. He will do what he says. But I think the accumulation of the wrongdoing, he would come home at night and say, I mean, he'd be back at the house and say, oh, well, this will blow over. I said, blow over? You're giving Hirsch and all these characters, Woodward, they're calling, you're talking to them, you're giving them more than you should be giving. Because Fritz, you're maybe being slightly disingenuous. He offered you documents that you didn't even ask for.
Sometimes he did that, but sometimes he was slower. Take the assassination effort on Castro. We were onto that and all over that. But the assassination effort of Lumumba in Congo, who does get killed, and the CIA wanted him killed, but I think the Congolese probably did it on their own, though it isn't crystal clear. But your father didn't immediately supply the documents on Lumumba until we knew a little bit, pushed him. So I think he was straightforward. I'm certain he told the truth, and I think it was largely for those good government reasons.
He
wasn't just rolling over.
It's not a loose compliment, but I think that he trusted the process. And I'll throw you a compliment here, but you always exhibited to me, and you're a bit older now, but a boyish idealism.
Uh-huh.
You're not cynical. Yeah. You've never been cynical. And it's a bit like I interviewed Patrick Leahy for this, and I put him in some of the extra scenes. And he turned Leahy, chairman of the judiciary and old friend of my dad's, believe it or not, said to me, well, the American people, what are we afraid of? If we're doing something illegal and we shouldn't be doing it, or we judge it to be illegal, improper, then don't do it and live with the consequences, which might be horrific. I mean, that might mean an attack on a subway system or whatever, but live by your principles. And I think he had that sort of free-spiritedness that you exhibit. I mean, this is the ultimate compliment, but Fritz, you would have been one of the founders.
Oh, that's very nice. I'm looking that old now? Holy
Nobody has a belief. You've always had a belief in the integrity of the law and the Constitution, which amongst the agency crowd, and that's why there was this great split after my father was basically thrown on the ash heap, he really, I think, turned his back on the entire agency. He became another person. He sort of took the cloak off and obviously wasn't a member of the club anymore.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, as you know, left the agency at that time, obviously removed. And a chilling thing that you might have asked me, why did you make the movie? But I remember 9/11, around 11 o'clock in the morning, watching the towers fall. Wolf Blitzer is interviewing former Secretary of State James Baker. And he asks Baker, how did this happen? And Baker said, I trace this back directly to the Church and Pike hearings when William Colby revealed the family jewels and decimated America's ability to conduct covert action and clandestine activities around the world, leading to incidents just like this.
Yeah, and you know, the interesting part for someone saying something like that is that between the Church Committee and 9/11, there were Republican presidents who reinforced the same rules that we had put in, like the FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, requirements that you get warrants before you wiretap Americans. Reagan, for one, praised that. So the Church Committee in 1976 caused a bombing in 2001, a bombing which, by the way, the CIA, doing a good job as they were, reported to the White House over this in the summer of 2001, lots of information that something very, 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 very big killing thousands of people was going to come. So I found that comment by Baker and some others as a little forced. So let me ask you, Carl, another thing. Thank you for the yeah, you're a founder, but founders.
You're a little taller than Madison, so.
Yeah. But no, not taller than Jefferson.
That's true.
So as you were at the dinner table, did your father talk about the investigations, and did he talk about the people doing them?
He did talk about the process. He was very calm about it, but I could feel that he had no particular support at the White House. There just wasn't that forthcoming. He was under pressure and like the odd man out, unlike someone like who I also interviewed and I put in some extra scenes, Secretary Bob Gates. And Gates just plainly said to me, he said he was in a completely different situation than my father because he had a strong president supporting him. During his confirmation hearing, he had Reagan backing him up, and this was in the midst of Iran-Contra when Gates is having to sort of explain himself away during that period, whereas my father had no support whatsoever. They really would have preferred that he just clam up. But Kissinger himself later on, about a year later, turned to my dad and said, "You're right. They would have torn the place apart." Didn't help my dad, of course.
No, and Kissinger, he was not like your father. He did not help in answer questions. He ducked and weaved. He refused to, swear to tell the truth. Now, an interesting person was Cheney, because there were about six pictures of Cheney there. And Cheney comes in and is the chief of staff right at the time.
Right.
And as deputy, he was trying to sabotage the church committee. But did you know anything about Cheney, or was he hiding himself?
No, he wasn't part of any process. Yeah. I mean, I got to know him a little bit, but particularly Rumsfeld, who is like is like a crocodile. You know, you cannot hurt him. He came to the initial screening in Washington, the premiere, and he's sitting next to Walter Pincus, which is pretty unusual. They're not exactly friendly, but they both thought it was very powerful. And I actually, maybe I'm enough of a contrarian or Jesuit trained that I wanted Rumsfeld to say that my father was a classic clandestine officer. And it was like a little salamander. You raise the rock, and here's this little character squirts out. He didn't have the social or political skills to deal with members of Congress. And I think that is true. I think from a management standpoint, this is a loaded question to you, but he did pretty much lose control of the process. I mean, it was on fire.
Yeah, once it got started, and with Ford being as weak as he was, we wouldn't have had an investigation if Ford had not been afraid to challenge our right to get information. And he was afraid because Nixon had fallen for trying to abuse secrecy and get the CIA to stop the FBI. So that was relevant.
Well, maybe before we open it up to questions, I would ask the obviously pregnant question, which is, that was then, but what do we have now? I mean, my chagrin, and I've been around the country showing the film, and people are concerned. And this president has his hands full with the economy and running for office, but this president is engaged in, if not as much, if not more covert action than any president since the Kennedys. And as David Ignatius wrote not long ago, it's very seductive. He likes it. It's a third way. There's very little accountability. And the White House is very good at deflecting attention off and blaming the agency if something goes wrong. So every other night, he gets the knock on the door or the telephone call, and, "Mr. President, will you sign this finding? We're heading off into Yemen or South Sudan tonight," and helicopter blades are whirling and waiting for the actual order. And he's engaging in a lot of this. And something more to your case too, but what about the fact that those rules of engagement or laws about killing Americans abroad are not even, they're still sealed,
but
law itself.
I think that's the single most disturbing thing. There are differences between trying to kill Castro and trying to kill Osama bin Laden. Clear differences. Osama bin Laden had declared war on us and acted in that way, and Castro was a pain in the butt, but he wasn't doing that. But there's no excuse for not releasing the reasoning they have for determining when they can use targeted killings. It's just inexcusable to hold that back. And I happen to be an admirer of Obama, but one should be very critical of that choice, which is that's a big step
back. I mean, maybe to compare, and I obviously put people like General McMaster, who's in the film, and he's now head of all intelligence in Afghanistan, works very closely with John Allen, who was a protege of my dad's. Obviously, the school of Mattis, Petraeus, Nagel, who was also in the film, who co-authored the counterinsurgency manual with Petraeus at Leavenworth, Rhodes Scholar. I mean, this is a different breed of cat who are running these wars now. They have learned the counterinsurgency lessons. But obviously, the operable question is, do we have the patience for these sorts of operations? The American people have a tendency to kind of drift off the attention span, and these are police actions, really. And here we've got U.S. Marines and Special Operations Forces. So it might be interesting to sort of examine why are we engaged in this conflict, and why isn't this president selling the war to the American people more effectively, just like we all remember, many of us. Johnson obviously did not succeed in selling the Vietnam War, and look at the consequence.
Yeah. But there probably were more consequences for Vietnam than failure to sell it, I think. So we should have questions for Carl, and most of them should be for Carl, and I'll ask and answer an occasional one.
Yes, ma'am.
One of the things is, you want names?
We're not writing them down.
This is intelligence. I didn't know what we were doing in here tonight. One of the things that amazes me is what seems to be the lack of courage by the members of Congress to take these issues on now. We could say, yes, there's a presidential election and so on, but I have been very disturbed by the failure of the committees, both the Democratic, when the Democrats were, well, they are more or less in the Senate, but not in the House, and not so much when Pelosi was in charge. So I'd like to have some sense of what you all think about that.
Well, I can just make a little anecdotal remark. I think it's very difficult to have, let's say, and it's a cheap shot probably, but I'll take it, someone like Michelle Bachmann is on the Intelligence Committee. She was running for president for a good 8 months. To be aware, to sit for the briefing by this gentleman who's going to come in and give you a 40-minute briefing, secret briefing about what's going on in the Sudan, what are the options that we have, read the literature, investigate this, have your staffers follow up. Is she spending the time? Is Senator Mark Udall in the Senate spending the time to listen to this gentleman tell you about those conditions? I'd have to ask you, because you actually were in those, you were in that position with the Church Committee, but you're certainly familiar with how intelligence committees operate. But that's the rub. I mean, is the time being spent? Because then you enter into what Walter Pincus talked about, which was chilling, when he makes that offhand remark that the executive and people in the agency and other places start to think that the Congress isn't really paying attention. They don't really need to know everything. If you're not listening to him, and you're not listening to the deputy director, then maybe I don't really need to keep you that abreast. I'll just keep rolling and keep it classified, and we'll just get on with business at hand.
Well, Congress goes up and down. Before the time of the Church Committee, the Congress preferred not to know. They preferred not to know about the CIA, and they gave J. Edgar Hoover a blank check. Then there was a period of vigor, and the intelligence committees were established, and they are a step in the right direction, but there are real problems with them, and Carl, you identified one of them. Are they paying enough attention? Some people do, like Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island on the Senate committee, really good. When I really hoped that President Obama was going to establish an independent commission to look at what has been done in and what has been done inappropriately as well as appropriately. And he made the decision not to do that, saying, let's look forward, not backward. That's a close call. I can understand. Someday there will be another investigation of what's happened since 9/11. And we will learn things many more than we know, many more than we know. And they're going to be really shocking. I promise you that. The courts are not perfect either. They genuflect, really, to the government when the government makes claims of don't produce material under a FOIA request that's because it's national security. And the courts do not do their job.
I mean, my sense is, and this is quoting from perhaps you, it's in your book, but you may have written these remarks, when you said your conclusion was, despite our distaste for what we've seen, obviously the...
I did write those remarks.
Well, it's worth repeating. We have great faith in this country. The story is sad, but this country has the strength to hear the story and to learn from it. We must remain a people who confront our mistakes and resolve not to repeat them. If we do not, we will decline. But if we do, our future will be worthy of the best of our past. And, you know, the Federalists wouldn't have been too unhappy with those papers, those remarks. Do you feel discouraged, or are you still optimistic?
Well, I'm not a person who gets discouraged, but we have problems. They're the same problems, and we should do better with them. Jack?
I'd like to hear a little more about the question of law. I can't modulate my voice. On your father, that is, you talked about his faith, and you talked about his loyalties, but it's not every legally trained person who follows quite these paths. So I wonder whether there's a separate inquiry or a separate line of discussion as the effect on him of law.
Well, I think his beliefs were grounded in the law and Judeo-Christian principles, and my mother euphemistically used to refer to CIA as Catholics in action. So he was very mission-oriented. At the same time, like the Jesuit who was in the film, if there are moral justifications or legal justifications for taking someone's life in a conflict situation, then perhaps you can mislead them. I think he, though, always sought to have a legal underpinning. So when Steve Young at the end of the Phoenix program section says that my father was troubled, perhaps, by are these controls inadequate, I think he genuinely did feel troubled that they were inadequate. At the same time, it's a chilling thing to say, but as you can see, I presented both someone like Bob Carey, lost his leg, Medal of Honor winner, Navy SEAL, Phoenix program. He calls it straight out assassination. I don't say that. James Reston interviewed me for hours and wanted me to say my dad was an assassin. He's not. My father probably fell more on what James Schlesinger coldly said. If you are squeamish about engaging in these kinds of practices and fighting a war of that sort, then you best get out because you're going to lose. And yet I see again, I think these same practices are coming into play in our, particularly the anti-terrorist operations that are engaged in now. I don't mean the normal counterinsurgency, but the just this really rough fight that's being taken to the enemy. And yet there's a vacuum of discourse and dialogue, particularly in Washington. And you know, traveling around, you hear people moan about it here and there, but there are no hearings. There are hardly even articles written about it.
You know, one more point about Congress. I would put a good deal of blame on them for not doing more, but the way the executive branch briefs them is not really workable, because the congresspeople can't take notes, they can't have their staff person with them, they can't talk about what they've heard with their staff person. So that's a formula that started out with possibly a decent idea that if, when you have descriptions of covert actions for Congress, you don't want to tell all 480 or whatever it is people, but it's being done in a way that makes it even harder for Congress to do their job.
Yes, sir.
You made reference to a Jesuit background. I went to college in Washington, D.C. from 64 to 68 at a Jesuit school, and a lot changed during that period of time. The main difference was that you had a draft, you know, and that changed radically, and that's what's very much different from the 60s versus what's happened in the last decade. You made reference to your Jesuit background and to what degree Jesuit values may have influenced your father. I don't know whether he had Jesuits before Columbia. And
no, he didn't, but he was very Catholic, and my mother was as well. Not, you know, hair shirt, evangelical type, worldly, obviously. But you can see it reflected in my mother's remarks about the moral compass. I remember them arguing on Memorial Bridge in 1963 after the killing of Ziem, and she was asking him, "What happened, Bill? What went wrong?" And he said, "Well, it went wrong." But then I knew that he vehemently opposed the coup. And I asked him after the coup went south, when I was only 13 years old, I said, "Well, why didn't you resign then?" He said, "I'll never resign. I can really change things. I can work from within to make the changes that need to happen." And yet I see the dialogue with JFK and RFK, and he's almost ruefully debating the positive, the pros and cons of what action should be taken. I think he understood that kind of conflict, and he was a soldier. He was a warrior. He was not afraid. His favorite expression, I almost named the movie this, but nobody would understand it, is "The Sound of the Guns." His dictum was, "March towards the sound of the guns." In other words, get into the fight of your era, of your time. My sister volunteered and went to work on a kibbutz in the Golan Heights. She had epilepsy. She was enjoying herself. Everything was fine. And then they said, "Well, you have epilepsy, you can't be here. You're under medication, you have to leave." And it was devastating to her. It was like a decline from then on. I remember my father coming back from Israel once and telling me that he'd seen a woman with a baby, another child on one arm, and then an automatic rifle. And that was just terrific. Well, it's like the woman leading with the flag, you know, for the Republic of France. That was his idea. Not to exaggerate, but in our family, we most admired martyrs, saints, and, you know, more warriors. Saint George the Dragon Slayer, my mother's favorite, Saint Sebastian, who was tortured twice by the Romans, and he was a centurion, twice. She liked that. She didn't like the ancient Romans, she liked the Christians, the martyrs. We would go to the tombs of the catacombs almost every Sunday. My mother knew the names of all 222 or so Roman emperors and what their stories were. It's just like being steeped in history. It was a great upbringing. But I got a sense that they were operating at this higher level and in a way almost competing. She was holding him to a standard, and by God, he would perform.
Carl, you said something in that answer near the beginning that was interesting, that you had a discussion with your father in which you said, "Why didn't you resign, I guess, over the coup?" Was that at the time or much later?
No, that was shortly after that, because it was common knowledge, and we had spent that time with him. And
but that suggests to me that he was more willing to talk about his work than I would have thought.
Offhand, he would say something. Mm-hmm. If you, a bit like the story I tell, you never knew what the real cause of something was. He said, "We're going to take a little trip, sport, whatever. We're going to take a fly down to Phu Quoc Island." We're in Saigon. And I rarely went on a trip on my own with my dad. You know, there were other kids, so why would I go alone? We got on the Air Vietnam and C-47, you know, over the Delta. And he looks out, and I'm at the window and pointing things out and going across the Mekong. And he literally said, "There's a war coming. This is all going to change." but not in a threatening way, like he was going to get hurt, but he was going to be involved in it. And then where did we go? Fuquoc Island later became the island with all the prison cages. Why did we take the trip on a Saturday? He probably didn't take me there just to go on a fishing trip.
Yeah.
He probably met with a few people, and I don't really remember who, but he was like that. The deft blending of the personal and the professional. Yes, sir.
Why did you wait so long to make a documentary of your father, A? And B, having decided to do so, did you receive any communications from the intelligence community to perhaps discourage you to bring all these matters
up? No, I'll answer the second question first. I had no discouragement from the agency. As a matter of fact, I called them up, and I know a bunch of people out there, obviously, and so I went out and asked them if they'd give me any documents or anything, and they gave me some redacted articles about the pacification program, and then not long ago they sent me, or through another person, received his official CIA biography, which has now been released and declassified, and but I never asked for any special treatment. I didn't want to be in any position where I'm revealing secrets or anything of that sort. And but I got very good feedback. As soon as the film came out, a few days later, I got a call from someone at the agency rather high up who said, I said, well, so what'd you think? And they said, well, very powerful. They said, every young CIA recruit should see this film. So we're going to set up a screening for all the clandestine officers in the bubble soon. But the other question would be, you're right, why didn't I? The reason was is that I would do profiles of people, and I would find myself in Washington with camera crews shooting other people. Why wouldn't I go over to his house and interview him? The reason is that he would be fine about, let's say, talking about Gorbachev, or if it was now, he would talk about Assad and Tehran and what's going on with the nuclear program. But if I asked him, you know, why'd you divorce my mother, he'd be like, he just sort of glaze over. And just, that's your department, friend. I should say that. Anything emotional, that's your department. As if I have some special skills. And he didn't traffic in that. He just kind of glazed over and looked past me. And I knew not to go there. So it would be frustrating to have engaged in any real interview, because it would have been unsatisfying to me, I think, in the end.
So let's do maybe three more questions, and
then,
sure. In terms of talking about intelligence, thank you. Intelligence, you're talking about the intelligence of how we see others. Are we looking at the intelligence or recognizing the intelligence of how others see us? When we talk in terms of Vietnam, it was mentioned that Diem was more French than he was Vietnamese. He was a Catholic in a Buddhist country. And we went there thinking we were doing good. But no, the people did not look at us as do-gooders. They looked at us as invaders and interlopers. I was there January 68. And I'm thinking also in Anwar Sadat was time man of the game.
Maybe if your question is what are we doing now, I would say that in something like Syria or Iran, I think we're very actively and deftly, really, with a light footprint, doing as much as possible. I mean, someone...
No, I think you're misrepresenting
the question.
Well,
ask the question and then we'll...
Okay, the question is how others are looking at us. We the people, we the military, we the politicians of America. Pakistan is not looking at us as do-gooders. Afghanistan is not looking at us as do-gooders.
And
neither is Vietnam.
So the question is, do our intelligence agencies sufficiently understand how other people are looking at us?
And accurately reflecting that and reporting that?
I mean, I'd say sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Well, my father used to hire a lot of journalists, but that's verboten now.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah. No, you should know that.
Oh, hiring them, paying them.
Paying
one thing. Hiring them is to come in and actually work for you. That would be okay.
No, I mean undercover.
You know, paying them, yes.
Yes, sir.
How did you persuade your mother to contribute the way that she did? It could not have been easy for her.
Well, she's been through a lot, and I'm quite close to her, and I basically, it's kind of funny, I set up a lot of interviews with people, OSS people and agency people and all that, and I thought as an afterthought, well, I'll ask my mother to be interviewed, maybe she'll have something to say. And so I interviewed her the first time, and she was very good, and I thought, well, that was very interesting, and then she called me up a week later and said, well, how was that? And I said, well, it's very good, it's very, you're very glib, and the Italy section and all. And she said, you know, I'd like to go and do more. I'd like to be a little more serious. I think I was a little too fun. I have some serious things to talk about. I said, you know, I feel the same way. I think, you know, maybe you can kind of get at the underneath. So fine. So she came back, and that's why you see sort of two versions of it. One sort of gay and fun, and the other one sober. And then I would bring a microphone to her apartment, and we would just talk, or to a recording studio. And it was a little strange, because after a while it dawned on me, I mean, obviously I think my mother's terrific, but my mother's talking to me. She's not talking to you. She didn't realize she's going to talk to you. She's talking to me. So that's why she says things like, Carl, we did this, or, and she's a tough bird. We used to say it's like Barbara Stanwyck with an Ivy League education. And she grew up four blocks from here, you know, on 8th Street in the village. And her father had died young, and she was tough. If you got home, or if my dad came back and there wasn't a good answer, she put the finger on it. And so I think it was a shared sort of mission. Yes, sir.
Follow up on that. What I asked you before the movie, and I'm still very curious about it, is what it's like for you to do a movie about your father, dig, probe, get candid answers. It's one thing for the Congressional Committee to want to get to the bottom of stuff. What happens when you make a movie about your father and you get to the bottom of stuff? And some of the things that you put in, especially towards the end, I imagine were not easy to do. And you told me you worked many years on this, but I really, because I could imagine for everybody in this room, if they were told, do a biography or a movie about your father, wow, we would think long and hard about it. So I was wondering what your personal reaction and experience from all this has been.
Well, maybe the best way to say it is that I used to argue with him about things. I adored him as a young boy, obviously. He's the parachuter and everything. And then later he's on a street corner in Saigon, and he says, look over there. What do you see? Well, a bicycle shop, and a pedicab going by, and a couple of guys getting in a car. Look a little closer. I look, and I say, well, you know, that one guy seems to be lingering, like waiting for somebody. And he went up the stairs, and now he's come down again. And another guy over there looks kind of nervous, and I've seen him go in and out of that building. He goes, now you're starting to see. It's like he wasn't a person. He was just a force. And it became very difficult for me in my early 20s to really even have an opinion about anything. Because we were taught just to drink it in. He would consider it extremely successful to have come tonight and to sat back there and had drinks with everybody and be the last person that you would remember here at the event. But he would have made sure to talk to Fritz and you and glean whatever information that he can from you. There's no ego, or very little one. And it's a very strange characteristic. Imagine, we live in a world of Facebook. People are tweet people. I just went to Subway sandwich. I like it with lettuce and tomatoes. How do you like it? Oh, actually, I don't like it with it. Shut up, who cares? This is a whole agency full of people who only have their own families or their own coworkers to slap them on the back. And I think he's just built out of a different cloth. So it was a struggle in some ways to do the film, but I think my mother was kind of my ally, and so let's leave it at that.
Well, maybe that's a good place to stop. And Carl, that was a courageous film. It was really a great service, and I think you should be very proud of what you've done. So thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.